The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Good evening. Edwin S. Simon reporting. NBS News has obtained Pentagon documents that show our neighbor to the north, the sovereign nation of Canada, has embarked on a military program aimed at the United States. Canada, known for ages as a polite and clean country, has, under a socialist majority, undertaken a massive military buildup on its border with the United States.
I don't like Canada. It's freezing cold.
Canada owns more of the U.S. than any other country.
The Canadians. They walk among us. William Shatner, Michael J. Fox, Monty Hall, Mike Myers, Alex Trebek. All of them Canadians, all of them here.
Is Canadian Prime Minister Clark MacDonald a member of a satanic cult?
Most of Canada's vast military technology has been built and supplied by the United States. The Canadian National Tower in Toronto, erected to transmit nuclear attack warnings from radar stations in northern Canada, is now solely in Canadian hands. It is the height of six American football fields, or five Canadian football fields, as if Canadian football really counts. What would be the psychological motivation to erect a huge, long, rigid shaft?
First of all, there is no Canadian culture. I've never read any Canadian literature. And when have you ever heard anyone say, honey, let's stay in and order some Canadian food?
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, November 5th, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
U.S. President Donald Trump may have more grounds for envisaging Canada as a 51st state than even he imagines. Unless, of course, he already knows about Canada's precarious legal status as a nation. Because if he does, then it's a trump card he has yet to play in his ongoing tariff war with Canada. On the heels of our show last week, during which we attempted to explain why Canada sucks, that discussion was initiated by the actions of Ontario's Progressive Conservative government, led by Ontario Premier Doug Ford. Ford managed to piss off Trump enough for Trump to cease all trade negotiations with the entire nation of Canada. Trump was reacting to a misleading political ad, run in the United States no less, featuring former U.S. President Ronald Reagan speaking in favor of the use of tariffs, well, except for the fact that that part was left out of Reagan's original speech in the Ontario paid-for ad. There's so much wrong with this picture that we'll have to take a second look at it, especially given Doug Ford's continuing to defend the misleading ad. Today's journey into troubled Canadian waters takes us well beyond Canada's socialist utopia, into historical territory that suggests that the North American British colonies, the United States, and Great Britain are all deeply entangled in creating what came to be called the country of Canada. It's a journey that should make most Canadians a bit uncomfortable, and that may contain some valuable lessons for any people in the process of creating a free and prosperous nation. And it all begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Let me make it clear from the outset that just because I'm a Canadian who happens to live in the province of Ontario, I am in no way responsible for the actions of my so-called Democratic representative, Doug Ford. I didn't vote for him to do any of the stupid and simply unconscionable things he's done during his reign as Premier of Ontario. Together with his federal counterpart, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, their mutual war against Donald Trump and his tariffs is a war they could have won without any effort, simply by securing the Canadian border to prevent illegal aliens from entering either country and by cutting down on Canada's illicit drug cartels, and of course, by ending their own tariffs. Instead, both Canadian politicians, who openly support Canadian tariffs themselves, are self-righteously condemning and criticizing Donald Trump for reacting in kind. And beyond the hypocrisy, there is a simple dishonesty involved by editing a speech intended for a specific purpose in such a way as to imply the opposite of its intentions. You'd think that after having the fraudulent misrepresentation exposed, that Doug Ford might have taken a step back to reconsider his strategy. But no, the man is oblivious to reality itself and is shamelessly bragging about what a great accomplishment his ad represented. On October 24, Brian Lilly posted a statement from Ontario Premier Doug Ford. He's pulling the ads at the request of PM Mark Carney, as its headline read. And that quoted statement read, quote, "Our intention was always to initiate a conversation about the kind of economy that Americans want to build and the impact of tariffs on workers and businesses. We've achieved our goal, having reached U.S. audiences at the highest levels. I've directed my team to keep putting out our message in front of Americans over the weekend so we can air our commercial during the first two World Series games. In speaking with Prime Minister Carney, Ontario will pause its U.S. advertising campaign effective Monday so that trade talks can resume. The people elected our government to protect Ontario, our workers, businesses, families, and communities. That's exactly what I'm doing. Like I said earlier today, Canada and the U.S. are neighbors, friends, and allies. We're so much stronger when we work together. Let's work together to build Fortress AmCan and make our two countries stronger, more prosperous, and more secure," end quote. And in his own tweet posted on October 27, Doug Ford wrote, quote, "Ontario's ad was intended to initiate a conversation about the impact of tariffs on American workers. In 7 days, it achieved 11.4 billion views, raising awareness of President Reagan's warnings against protectionism," end quote. To which Paul McKeever, leader of the Freedom Party of Ontario, responded, quote, "11.4 billion viewers? There are scarcely more than 8 billion people on Earth, and most of them are starving and lacking internet. Most of the rest don't give a crap about your commercial. Congratulations, Captain Underpants at Ford Nation. You ended Canada. We're gone," end quote. Well, gone might be an understatement, but we'll save that story until after we hear from Doug Ford himself, who on this side of our upcoming bumper, as presented to us by David Freiheit, who, by the way, happens to be another one of those Canadians living amongst the Americans. Calling his October 28th podcast Ford's Tour of Shame, Doug Ford certainly didn't seem to see it that way. And on the return side, Rebel Media's David Menzies cites a video of Mark Carney speaking to reporters about the Ontario Doug Ford ad.
Canadian Premier Doug Ford, and a Canadian premier is like a governor of a state in America, squandered $75 million on an ad that he aired on American television as relates to the tariff war, and now he's on Jake Tapper, CNN, doing a tour of shame.
This guy is an absolute buffoon.
This all started with a political ad that Doug Ford, he's the premier of the province of Ontario, paid $75 million for, ran on American television stations, for some reason as though that could not arguably be deemed to be interfering with American politics, squandered dollars to run a political ad in America, and now he had to do something of a tour of shame, because after that ad aired, Donald Trump severed all negotiations with Canada as relates to the tariff war. Now the only problem with that ad is that it took statements made by President Ronald Reagan totally out of context, where they aired these statements that Ronald Reagan made, ostensibly condemning tariffs and promoting total open borders, except they cut out the 55 seconds of that very video in which he begged to retain the right to impose tariffs, selective as he might think they are. He begged for the right to retain tariffs as a negotiating tool. They just clipped that part out of the video because, you know, they have to lie when telling the truth. Well, ever since Trump cut off all trade talks with Canada, I think some Canadians might have gotten a little mad at Dougie Ford, and he's now doing something of a tour of shame, and his first stop is Jake Tapper's CNN. In a tweet from, I think, give or take March, I'll double check the date, Viva Fry at the Viva Fry, the reasons given, whether you choose to believe them or not, had to do with 1. Unacceptable numbers of people on terror watch lists attempting to cross into the US from Canada due to Canada's terrible immigration policies, and 2. Canada's horrendous drug problem in Canada and its impact on the states. Some may think these excuses were pretextual, in which case all the Canadian government had to do was respond to these concerns in order to eliminate the quote pretext end quote for a tariff war. Instead, Canada chose to wage a tariff war that will hurt Canadians exponentially more than anyone in the US. But that's what communist regimes do, make their citizens suffer so they can find a boogeyman to blame it on. But Doug Ford screwed everything up, and now he's out doing a mea culpa tour. First stop, Jake the Fake Tapper on Communist News Network CNN.
And we're back with more in our world lead. While President Trump makes progress on trade in Asia, he is currently icing out America's neighbor to the north, announcing an additional 10% tariff on Canada, apparently irked by a TV ad paid for by the Canadian province of Ontario, an ad that ran on U.S. TV networks, an ad that used parts of an anti-tariff speech by former President Ronald Reagan in 1987. That TV ad ran over the weekend, including during the World Series, and joining us now is the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. So you said this morning that this was, quote, the most successful ad in the history of North America. Is the additional 10% tariff on Canadians also part of that success?
Well, first of all, Jake, thanks for having me on. I start off every interviewing saying that Canadians love Americans. I love America. I love Americans. I lived there for 20 years. And that my intention was to bring this to the American people and tell them that tariffs, protectionism, does not work. Ronald Reagan was a free trader, the greatest president, in my opinion, ever. And we wanted to get the message out.
Tariffs, protectionism does not work, except in industries where they want protectionism, such like dairy, meat coming out of Canada, where they have imposed tariffs for years. Yeah, it doesn't work where you don't want it to work, and it works where you want it to work, and tariffs are good when you impose them, but they're bad when America imposes them. And by the way, why the heck is he airing this anti-tariff ad in America during the World Series? This is actual political interference coming by way of an idiot from Ontario. And then we get into the impressions, because Doug Ford, all he cares about is impressions on social media. Well, he got the impressions they wanted, except that each impression cost about a dollar.
And yeah, was it, did the message get out? 100%. It had 11.4 billion, with a B, impressions, we talked in the media, but views around the world. Mm. And again, we just want to make sure that we work side by side with our closest friends and allies. A tariff on Canada is a tax on Americans.
And the cost of those impressions, probably about $11.4 billion on Canada.
CNN's news gathering partner, CBC, reports that you're anti-Trump rhetoric, your criticism of Trump, came up repeatedly during trade negotiations. Was that intentional at all, being the bad cop?
Well, you know, I've never said anything personal about President Trump. In our ad, it was very ironic that President Trump saw it and he said, yeah, that was a good ad. If I was Canada, I'd run the same ad. And then all of a sudden he wakes up in the morning, someone whispers something in his ear, and now he's not happy. But it was an ad to inform the people in the U.S., and mission accomplished.
Canada's unemployment rate, as I'm sure I don't need to tell you, is now at its highest point in 9 years. Do you have any regrets about stirring the pot, possibly making things harder on your fellow Canadians due to this retaliation from President Trump?
No, I don't believe so. The person that started this whole thing around the world, not just with Canada, is President Trump, and the American people are finally feeling the effects of tariffs, and it's going to continue. The more tariffs is more of a tax on Americans and less jobs for America.
But a Canadian premier paying $75 million to air political ads in America, that is nothing shy of foreign interference in domestic politics. And it's so bad that even the three-passport-carrying globalist whore that is Mark Carney, the new Prime Minister of Canada, had to spank Doug Ford into submission. Listen to this.
After you spoke with your Prime Minister, Mark Carney, you paused the campaign, effective today, so the trade talks could resume. Did Carney demand that you do that?
No, he doesn't demand anything of me. I have a job to protect the largest economy in Canada, the engine of Canada, 16.5 million people, and that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm protecting the steel jobs, the auto jobs, the life science jobs, the manufacturing jobs. That's my duty as the Premier of Ontario.
Video. It's Mark Carney speaking with reporters about Trump's announcement last night, the announcement pertaining to that ludicrous, I think, $75 million ad by Doug Ford.
For months, we have stressed the importance of distinguishing things we can control and things we can't control. We can't control the trade policy of the United States. We recognize that that policy has fundamentally changed from the policy in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s. And it's a situation where the United States has tariffs against every one of their trading partners to different degrees. And it's in that context that our officials, my colleagues, have been working with their American colleagues on detailed, constructive negotiations, discussions, on specific transactions, specific sectors, steel, aluminum, and energy, and a lot of progress has been made. And we stand ready to pick up on that progress and build on that progress when the Americans are ready to have those discussions, because it will be for the benefit of workers in the United States, workers in Canada, and families in both of our countries.
You know, Dre, I don't know about you, but listening to Mark Carney seems to be a substitute for Sominex so often. What was he saying there?
Yeah, he's just going, all I could see was him saying, yeah, we're screwed. We don't know what we're doing. Or maybe he knows what they're doing.
Well, that was another serving of word salad dribbling from the mouth of Mark Carney, creating the same effect in David Menzies as it does to me. It puts me to sleep and never makes any cohesive sense. No wonder he's Canada's prime minister. And as we heard from Ontario Premier Doug Ford, he not only has no shame about the blatant misrepresentation of how his Ronald Reagan ad was edited, but he is proud of his message. This points to a very serious moral defect in the man, compounding his obvious intellectual defect, since clearly to him, truth and context of his arguments are irrelevant to his objectives, and that means that the ends justify the means for Ford. And worse, his ends are totally destructive to both the Ontario and Canadian economies. But what I want to know is, where are all the usual gang of anti-Trumpers who scream election interference at the drop of a feather or create it as outright fiction because they regard election interference as grounds enough to nullify the results of an election? I mean, the evidence is incontrovertible. Ford himself is not only admitting to foreign electoral interference, but is boasting about it. As David Freiheit observed, a Canadian premier advertising in the USA is nothing short of foreign interference. And personally, I agree. This was the very question I raised on last week's show. Why a provincial politician like Doug Ford would interfere in American politics is a question no doubt being considered by the Trump administration. Ford faces no immediate election prospects himself, so he has no current need to promote his party. And more to the point, his ads certainly were not promoting Ontario in any way or making any kind of Ontario-oriented provincial statement. In fact, by his own words, Ford made it clear that the ads were not intended for an audience within the jurisdiction of his own government, which is Ontario. My intention was to bring this to the American people to tell them that tariffs and protection does not work, says Ford. Well, if tariffs don't work, then why does Canada use them? And why won't the Canadian government drop its tariffs, which have been in place for years? And if a tariff on Canada is a tax on Americans, then why isn't a tariff on America a tax on Canadians? I mean, the hypocrisy is mind-numbing. And let's not forget that in the very recent hit-and-run provincial election called by Doug Ford at the beginning of this year, his provincial campaign was always focused on attacking Trump and his tariffs, rather than on opposing his political rivals in the province. Similarly, during the last Canadian federal election, soon-to-be Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney also declared Trump his political opponent, while generally ignoring his actual Canadian political opposition. Ford said that Trump saw the ad and said it was a good ad, and if I was Canada, I'd run the same ad. Really? Does Ford actually expect anyone to believe that? Because if Trump actually said that, it would mean that Trump is willing to misrepresent a political position opposed to his own for the purposes of undermining his own agenda. Clearly, Ford is delusional. He boasts about getting 11.4 billion impressions, and that's billion with a B, and therefore, hey, mission accomplished. Okay, so I'm impressed. If that's what Ford calls an accomplishment, Ontario is in deep trouble. Everything the man has accomplished is a pile of bullcrap, and that's bull with a B. And when Ford was challenged on CNN to address the fact that Canada's unemployment is at its highest rate in years, he basically avoided any responsibility or role in that, saying that, I have no regrets. Trump started it. Wow. Started what, you may ask? Well, for starters, homelessness and poverty are rampant on a scale never before experienced in Canada. MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying, continues to exterminate Canadians at a rate never before experienced, even if only over depression or poverty. The economy is suffering under extreme inflation. Illegal aliens are flooding the country. Housing shortages are rampant. The auto industry is collapsing. Healthcare waiting lists continue to grow. Guns are being confiscated. Violent protests by the left continue to get police protection, while peaceful media members covering those protests get arrested by police. And for a similar list of symptoms exclusive to Ontario itself, check out our February 19 broadcast, Ontario's Hit-and-Run Election, Driven by a Ford, featuring our guest, Freedom Party of Ontario leader Paul McKeever. The sad fact is that in the middle of what was a provincial election, few voters were even aware of Ontario's jurisdictional powers or limits, concerned only with their narrow self-interests, unrelated to provincial issues. Most voters, lobby groups, and the media were completely disconnected from any issues relevant to Ontario provincial politics during that election. Even Doug Ford, in threatening to restrict trade and impose tariffs on America, was oblivious to the fact that such actions are not open to him given that they fall exclusively within federal jurisdiction. Now think about that for a moment. During the last Ontario provincial election, which ran from January 29 to February 27, Ford was openly doing exactly what he's now condemning Donald Trump for. In fact, at one point, Ford even threatened to cut Ontario supplies of electricity to America, quite willing to do harm to the very Americans he now claims to be speaking for. And let me say that from years of personal experience in Ontario politics, that the last election was a complete train wreck, from the arbitrary way in which it was called and administered to the total irrelevancy attributed to any provincial issues or concerns during that election. Now, at the end of all this, there may be a great irony in the way Doug Ford has exercised his provincial premiership in a prime ministerial manner. Canada's own prime ministers have been calling Canada a post-national state, befitting their globalist agendas and their resistance to recognizing national sovereignty. Unless, of course, it's for, you know, a territory like Ukraine or Gaza. But the more you look into Canada's problems, the more you realize that Canada has a lot more than just an identity problem. It has an existential problem in terms of actually being a sovereign nation. And it is to that dilemma that we now turn our attention. Back in December 2024, just this past December, my attention was brought to a documentary film entitled Canada, the Illusion, which is easily accessible on multiple platforms via a simple search for that title. Produced by Tim Stein, spelled with two M's, in collaboration with Xander LaRue, Doug Forrest, and The Myth is Canada, the documentary boasts that this film is entirely based on fact and not on opinions. And to that end, it should be noted that each of the historical events and documents referred to in the documentary were visually illustrated on the screen, accompanied by long periods of background music without any narration. So for our strictly audio purposes today, we've edited what we're about to hear down to the essential narrated parts of the documentary, which include a lot of details and specific references that may seem overwhelming at certain points, but which are not necessary to memorize in order to arrive at the big picture of the myth that is Canada.
Canada. A land of endless opportunities, extraordinary beauty, and prosperity. A place that is known for kindness, benevolence, and generosity. A place that is built on courage, integrity, and truth. Or so it appears. Yet, something doesn't feel right. Can you feel it? The underlying sense of unease and discomfort. That feeling when you know you're being deceived. And you're wondering, how big of a lie could it be? In 1759, at the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, Great Britain defeated France and renamed the colony to the province of Quebec. In 1776, the 13 British colonies to the south declared independence from Great Britain and formed the United States of America. In 1791, the Constitutional Act divided the province of Quebec into the provinces of Lower Canada and Upper Canada. In 1840, the Act of Union merged the colonies of Upper Canada and Lower Canada into the province of Canada. In 1864, at the Quebec Conference, delegates from each colony discussed the desire to form a federal union, while each province would retain its independence and autonomy under the umbrella of a constitutional monarchy. From 1861 to 1865, during the American Civil War between the Union, the North, and the Confederacy, the South, Great Britain built warships for the Confederacy, armed with British weapons. Many merchant ships of the Union were destroyed by the Confederate Army in Great Britain. When Lincoln won the war, he sought claims from Great Britain, but Great Britain refused. The Union even threatened to declare war and annex British North America in 1866. In 1866, John A. Macdonald, chairman of the delegates from the colonies, participated in finalizing the Kingdom of Canada Bill at the London Conference to draft the BNA Act. Great Britain had a dilemma: risk a possible war with the United States of America, pay reparations for the sinking of the Union's ships, grant the colonies in Canada self-governance. Queen Victoria needed a clever solution. Lord Thring's brilliant scheme: keep the Canadian colonies and make them pay the reparations to the United States of America through taxation, while deceiving the colonies into thinking that they govern themselves. On March 29, 1867, the British North America Act received royal assent, meaning it was formally approved by the court in Chancery. It went into effect on July 1, 1867, and created a united colony known as the Dominion of Canada. Until 1982, July 1 was celebrated as Dominion Day. Since 1982, July 1 has been celebrated as Canada Day, when the BNA Act was renamed the Constitution Act. Let us take a closer look at the original BNA Act, 1867. This is the intended preamble, and it states: by reason of the request of the colonies for federal government, it is expedient, therefore, that they have laws and regulations to guide them. This is the modified preamble, and it states: whereas the provinces of Canada, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick have expressed their desire to be federally united into one dominion under the Crown. The 1889 Interpretation Act defined a British possession to be any part of a dominion. and it defined the term colony to be any part of a dominion. The Dominion of Canada was clearly a colony of Great Britain and not an independent country. The colony did not confederate in 1867. The BNA Act was not brought back to Canada for the United Colony to sign and ratify. The original BNA Act is located in the United Kingdom and has always been the property of the United Kingdom and not Canada. Section 2 of the BNA Act, 1867, declares that the provisions of this act extend to the heirs and successors of the kings and queens of Great Britain. Section 109 of the BNA Act, 1867, states that all lands, minerals, and royalties belonging to the several provinces of Canada, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick at the Union shall belong to the several provinces of Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. All natural resources belong to the various colonies, with exceptions as per Section 109. More land was to be added to the Dominion of Canada through use. If the Dominion could use the land, then they could claim the land. In 1868, through the Rupert's Land Act, use of land was purchased from the Hudson's Bay Company. In 1870, through the Manitoba Act, and in 1871, through the British Columbia Terms of Union. In 1871, the Treaty of Washington was concluded. It settled the claims between the United Kingdom and the United States of America, even though the United Kingdom never admitted any wrongdoing. However, it is interesting to see whose names also show up. Sir John Alexander Macdonald, Knight Commander of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, a member of Her Majesty's Privy Council for Canada, and Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Her Majesty's Dominion of Canada. And Montague Bernard. The Privy Council is a formal body of advisors to the monarch of the United Kingdom, in this case, Queen Victoria, meaning John A. Macdonald represented Great Britain. In 1867, Macdonald was appointed, and not voted in, as Prime Minister by the Governor General at the time, Lord Monck. In 1854, Macdonald, a Freemason since 1844, became a member of the Order of the Masonic Knights Templar. Macdonald got engaged to the much younger Susan Agnes Bernard, cousin of Montague Bernard, who worked with British royalty in London in December of 1866. They married in February of 1867, 1 month before the BNA Act was signed. John A. Macdonald was the one who helped Queen Victoria achieve her grand scheme of deceiving the colonists into thinking they were now self-governed and had confederated. He received generous titles, appointments in the British monarchy, and a much younger second wife in addition to his annual salary of $5,000 equivalent to $125,000 today, in return for a betrayal of the colonists. In the Treaty of Washington, 1871, John A. Macdonald agreed to give the San Juan Islands and Point Roberts to the United States of America, in addition to granting equal rights to the fisheries for 10 years because he was representing Great Britain and not the Dominion of Canada. How can he be called the father of Confederation and a hero by some when a Confederation was never achieved and when he in fact betrayed the colonists? In September of 1926, Russell Rogers Smith of the Native Sons of Canada, a movement aimed at fostering national spirit, creating Canadian nationality, adopting a Canadian flag, and having more autonomy, presented a resolution to the Prime Minister, Mackenzie King. One main request of that resolution was the necessity of elevating Canada constitutionally to the status of a sovereign nation and to confer on Canada an equality of status with Great Britain. It requested an equal and independent sovereignty under the Crown of Canada. Another request was that Great Britain should not be allowed to make Canada pay for any claims that may arise out of Great Britain's defense actions. Another important request was that all natural resources of Canada belong to the people of Canada and not Great Britain. The resolution further requested that the roles and authority of the Governor General be fundamentally changed for the benefit of Canada. As we will see, it was the work of Russell Rogers Smith that would have paved the path to real freedom. In October of 1926, at the Imperial Conference in London, led by Lord Arthur J. Balfour, Mackenzie King, and representatives of the other Dominions of Great Britain met to discuss and determine the status between Great Britain and the Dominions of Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and the Irish Free State. The report concluded that the Dominions are autonomous communities within the British Empire, equal in status, in no way subordinate one to another in any aspect of their domestic or external affairs, though united by a common allegiance to the Crown, and freely associated as members of the British Commonwealth of Nations. This was scheduled to be made law with the enactment of the Statute of Westminster on December 11, 1931. Prior to the enactment of the Statute of Westminster, the Government of Canada was composed of a Governor-General and a select committee of the Imperial Privy Council, one of which headed the Supreme Court of Canada. Any member of the Imperial Privy Council was a member of the Government of Canada. The House of Commons, the Senate of Canada, the Privy Council for Canada, which was appointed by the Governor-General, and the Lieutenant Governors of the provinces were to aid and advise the Governor-General in the government. The Governor-General was the sole government. Neither the Legislative Assembly nor the House of Commons were responsible to the Canadian people. They were responsible to the Governor-General only. Each Lieutenant Governor, appointed by the Governor-General, was also a corporation soul, acting as the representative of the Governor-General, and not as a representative of elected representatives or the people. As we will see, the Statute of Westminster is the most important document in the history of the landmass known as Canada. We will only look at the three key sections of the Statute of Westminster that apply to the Dominion of Canada. These are: Section 2 removed colonial law from the Dominion of Canada. Recall, the Dominion of Canada was defined as a colony of Great Britain. No law made by the Parliament of a Dominion is void just because it may not be in accordance with British law. This section does not apply to Australia because Australia had a so-called constitution in 1901 and was not a Dominion in 1931. Let's look at Section 11 before looking at Section 7. Section 11 of the Statute of Westminster severed the connection between the Dominion and a colony of Great Britain. What does this mean? The key word is notwithstanding. It means Section 11 overrides the Interpretation Act of 1889, which defined the term colony. The provinces were not joined as one colony of Great Britain any longer, and each province was also not a colony of Great Britain any longer. Who owned the land now? The people of each province naturally took ownership of the land. This also removed the Governor General because the Crown and Chancery lost the allodial title to the land. There is no intermediate status between that of a colony and that of a sovereign state. No confederation happened because the provinces had never been sovereign states. Section 11 finally raised each province of Canada from the position of a colony to that of a sovereign state. Section 7 is misleading in how it deals with the applicability of this statute to Canada. Subsection 1 attempts to exclude the BNA Act from this statute. However, the BNA Act was only a statute, a guide, of the Imperial Parliament to aid the Governor General. It could only be effective if there is a duly appointed Governor General. See Section 12 of the BNA Act, 1867. Since the Crown and Chancery, who appoints the Governor General, gave up allodial title to the land thanks to Section 11, there can be no more Governor General. The result is, this subsection is redundant. Subsection 2 clarifies that Section 2 of the statute removing colonial law also applies to any of the provinces. This makes each province a sovereign state, nation, or country, because confederation never happened. Only sovereign states can join into a confederation, and the provinces were not sovereign until the Statute of Westminster was passed. Subsection 3 clarifies that the provinces can only act within their boundaries and cannot impose laws on any other province. But what is the Parliament of Canada now? Is Canada defined? In summary, Section 2 removed colonial law from the Dominion of Canada, as it was a colony of Great Britain. Section 7 removed colonial law from each province. Section 11 removed the status of colony, which immediately ended the Dominion of Canada. It also immediately removed the Governor General. There is no intermediate status between that of a colony and that of a sovereign state. Sovereignty and the ownership of land go hand in hand. No confederation happened because the provinces had never been sovereign states. Each province of Canada was now for the first time a sovereign state. This status has not changed since December 11, 1931. No province has held a constitutional convention. No province has ceded a de jure lawful government. Extremely important. Every politician, every governor general, every prime minister, every law, every act, everything has been illegitimate since December 11th, 1931. Anything that was passed after this date is not applicable to the people of each province. Has freedom been hiding in plain sight for over 90 years?
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. There certainly was a lot to absorb in what we just heard and have yet to hear. So to summarize what I take to be the most relevant and key points up to now, Tim Stein's assessment of Canada's father of Confederation, Sir John A. Macdonald, was certainly not consistent with what most Canadians are taught about Macdonald. Given Great Britain's dilemma of how to keep its Canadian colonies and make them pay reparations to the United States through taxation, deceiving the colonies into thinking that they were governing themselves was clearly the illusion on which the documentary is focused. As was illustrated, Macdonald represented the Queen and was appointed, not voted in, as Prime Minister by the Governor General at the time. Quote, John A. Macdonald was the one who helped Queen Victoria achieve her grand scheme of deceiving the colonists into thinking they were now self-governed, end quote. And, asks Stein, how can he be called the father of Confederation and a hero by some when a federation was never achieved and when he, in fact, betrayed the colonists? Good question. And the attempt by Russell Rogers Smith in his presented resolution to Prime Minister Mackenzie King to elevate Canada to the status of a nation, along with having its own flag, never was followed through on, although Canada did eventually end up with its own flag.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land, true in all
play Snowbird.
That's what I hate about coming here, you know? You gotta listen to that song all the time. Check out the flag. And what is that? Is that a weed on there or what? Great, nice flag.
Citing the December 11, 1931 Statute of Westminster as the most important document regarding the landmass known as Canada, the documentary eventually concludes that this makes each province a sovereign nation or country because Confederation never happened, which explains the irony about Doug Ford exercising his provincial premiership in a prime ministerial manner that I mentioned earlier. Because if each province is indeed a sovereign state or nation, then the irony is that Ford would have the authority to threaten tariffs abroad, although this would still not justify foreign electoral intervention. But Canada the illusion does not end here. There is more. As we ourselves have argued many times on past broadcasts of this show, in 1982, with the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Pierre Elliott Trudeau initiated the Grand Deception.
In 1976, Walter Cool, a member of Parliament from Alberta, wrote a letter to René Lévesque, Premier-elect of Quebec, explaining that Quebec does not need to seek a formal separation because the province has been completely independent and sovereign since December 11, 1931, just like every other province. How can you be divorced when you have never been married? In 1982, Pierre Elliott Trudeau initiated the Grand Deception that is called the Constitution Act of Canada, also known as the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. An illusion, as we will see, which many people strongly believe to be factual truth. Trudeau is said to have patriated, which means to transfer legislation to an autonomous country from its previous mother country. The defunct and meaningless DNA Act, 1867, to Canada. Why did he only bring a photocopy? Why does the original BNA Act, 1867, still reside in the parliamentary archives of Great Britain? Trudeau urged all provinces to ratify, which means to give formal consent to make something official, the document, so that Canadians could enjoy their new constitution as soon as possible. Did all the provinces sign? Was it ever ratified? Section 58 of the Canada Act, 1982, states that this act would only come into force by proclamation issued by the Queen or the Governor General, and only if the conditions of Section 59 were met. Section 59 is equally important to comprehend. Subsection 1. Paragraph 23, 1. A shall come into force in respect of Quebec on a day to be fixed by proclamation issued by the Queen or the Governor General under the Great Seal of Canada. Subsection 2. A proclamation under subsection 1 shall be issued only where authorized by the Legislative Assembly or Government of Quebec. Subsection 3. This section may be repealed on the day paragraph 23, 1A, comes into force in respect of Quebec and this act amended and renumbered consequentially upon the repeal of this section by proclamation issued by the Queen or the Governor General under the Great Seal of Canada. The key phrase here is in respect of Quebec. Section 23. Minority language educational rights. Citizens of Canada, whose first language learned and still understood is that of the English or French linguistic minority population, have the right to have their children receive primary and secondary school instruction in that language in that province. Recall Section 59, Subsection 3, in respect of Quebec. This section may be repealed on the day paragraph 23, 1A, comes into force in respect of Quebec and this act amended and renumbered consequentially upon the repeal of this section by proclamation issued by the Queen or the Governor General under the Great Seal of Canada. This means that only Quebec would lose their educational right in the French language. What were the steps to ratify and enact the Canada Act, 1982? 1. All provinces would need to sign Schedule B of the Act, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. 2. Quebec would need to authorize a proclamation to enact Section 23, 1A of the Act. 3. Section 23, 1A would be enacted through a proclamation. 4. Section 59, 3 would be enacted through a proclamation to repeal Section 59 and renumber the Act. 5. Section 58 would be enacted through a proclamation to pass the Act. A total of 3 proclamations were needed to pass the Act. Which of these steps have been completed? None. But what about the proclamation from 1982? From the Royal Proclamation, 1982. Now know you that we, by and with the advice our Privy Council for Canada, do by this our proclamation declare that the Constitution Act, 1982 shall, subject to Section 59 thereof, come into force. Recall, subject to Section 59 means 2 proclamations must be made before the final proclamation to pass the Act, Section 58, could be made. This Royal Proclamation, 1982, is only a proclamation stating that there will be a proclamation in the future. Nothing was passed. Nothing was enacted. There is no constitution. There is no charter of rights and freedoms. The Royal Proclamation, 1983, had nothing to do with the passing of the Canada Act, 1982. This act simply converted the status of Aboriginal people from sovereigns to persons. Let's take a look at the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Section 1. The Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in its subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. This gives the government the option to ignore the Charter, and it is why the courts often side with the government. Section 7. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. What is a person? Section 32. This charter applies to the Parliament and Government of Canada, and to the legislature and government of each province. Does the charter apply to the living men and women, or only to persons? A charter is a reservation of a ship, or a written grant, by which a corporation is founded and its rights and privileges are defined. A ship needs to be chartered to land it and reflag it. A person is a legal fiction. A corporation is also a legal fiction, but not a person. The charter was meant to create a ship at sea, which was intended to bring maritime law onto the land. Through persons, the living men and women would be brought under maritime law jurisdiction. This is why all provinces needed to sign the charter. A charter differs from a constitution in this, that the former is granted by a foreign government, while the latter is established by the people themselves. There is no lawfully established, independent country called Canada. There is a geographical area that is comprised of sovereign nations, also known as provinces. How exactly is Canada defined in the Interpretations Act, 1985? Canada includes the internal waters of Canada and the territorial sea of Canada. Canadian waters includes the territorial sea of Canada and the internal waters of Canada. Internal waters means the internal waters of Canada and includes the airspace above and the bed and subsoil below those waters. The land is not included anywhere. Why? Because they lost access to the land when the Dominion ended with the Statute of Westminster, when the land was naturally returned to the people through the person, the all caps name on all forms, IDs, licenses, passports, birth certificates, etc., you have submitted yourself to operate within maritime law. You have only those privileges that the corporation grants to you. Those do not include unalienable rights. Happened after the Statute of Westminster was passed? Did the people in each province hold constitutional conventions and cede a de jure government? Sadly, no. Russell Rogers Smith said in the 1940s, "What does the future hold? Is Canada to become an armed camp, each at the other's throat? Or can we unite to create a federal union, mutually adopting a constitution?" It is very likely that many people did not comprehend at the time what the Statute of Westminster had actually achieved. The Great Depression also impacted many people who were desperately looking for help. In addition, it is likely that many of the politicians at the time did also not comprehend what the passing of the Statute of Westminster really meant. It seems that those who did know simply continued as if nothing had happened. After all, there was a lot to lose. Recall, Section 109 of the BNA Act. In 1936, the Parliament of Canada attempted to revise the Statute of Westminster. They wanted to revise Section 7 of the statute to give the Parliament of Canada the power to enact a federal constitution and to continue the BNA Act until such constitution was in place. Did the Parliament have this power? Was the Parliament legitimate? Parliament also tried to amend the BNA Act. However, the BNA Act cannot be implemented without a Governor General. The Governor General used to be appointed by the Crown and Chancery, but the Crown and Chancery lost the title to the land. From the official website of the Governor General of Canada. Until 1931, Canada's Governor General was chosen by the sovereign. This changed when the Canadian government began to make recommendations for the position. In 1945, Walter Cool, a member of Parliament from Alberta, addressed the House of Commons and presented a detailed speech about the constitutional problems. He clearly outlined the current status and the actions that should be taken. However, no action was taken. In 1947, Prime Minister Mackenzie King issued letters patent, appointing a Governor General. These letters patent were signed only by Mackenzie King. To this day, only the Lord High Commissioner of Great Britain, the Crown and Chancery, can issue letters patent. Nobody else has the power or authority to issue letters patent. The last ones that were issued are dated March 23, 1931. In 1948, the Income Tax Act was implemented by an illegitimate Parliament of Canada and signed by an illegitimate Governor General, Harold Alexander of Tunis. In 1952, the Royal Style and Titles Act was enacted by an illegitimate Parliament of Canada, in which the Parliament of Canada assented that Elizabeth II can proclaim herself to be the Queen in right of Canada. Who owned the land of the Dominion of Canada? Did the land of the Dominion of Canada belong to the monarch? No. The Crown and Chancery held the title to all British lands, including the Dominion of Canada. The Crown and Chancery is the Department of Lands of Britain. It was established by the Privy Council. The Crown is a corporation sole. It represents the state in all its aspects. It can be used to refer to the office of the monarch or the monarchy as institutions. It can be used to refer to the rule of law or the functions of executive, legislative, and judicial governance. This is why all government and public land was called Crown land until it was granted by means of a Crown grant. also referred to as a land patent. The monarch was just a figurehead. The king or queen was not a sovereign any longer because they did not own the land. The governor general had more authority. He was also a corporation sole, given the sole government of the colony, with the assistance of members of the Privy Council and appointed by the Crown and Chancery. What is the difference between a monarch and a sovereign? Authority of government originates in the title to land. A king or queen is a sovereign when he or she has absolute authority over the land, and thus absolute power. A king or queen becomes a monarch when he or she does not have absolute authority over the land. The king or queen alone has no power. The title to all British lands was held by the Crown and Chancery and not by the King or Queen. All government and public land was called Crown Land. The Governor General had sole authority to govern Canada as a corporation sole with the advice of the Privy Council. He was appointed by the commission created in 1878 and not by the King or the Queen or the House of Commons or the House of Lords.
So, Canada exists in the political matrix, does it? Well, talk about a legal mess and entanglement, one which appears not to coincide with political practice. And does that mean that everything we just heard was not so? No, to the contrary, it is Canadian history, and it is factually true. But so, too, is the fact that the apparently fictional country of Canada has been operating as if it is a legitimate nation under some pre-established law. But this is more a paradox than it is a contradiction, as I will shortly explain.
These Canadians ain't got a care in the world.
Yeah, and how about the way they cheat at the World Series, huh? That's our game, people! Oh,
that is
huh?
True. I'll tell you another thing, the beer sucks.
Yowza! Amazing. And now, we understand what's really important to Canadians. Okay, so here's my take on all of this. Even though pretty much everything we've learned about the legal status of Canada so far is accurate, does it really matter? Because the bottom line is this. Every nation is a permanent work in process. There are no immutable laws or structures that can in any way preserve or protect any kinds of tradition that would somehow represent a finished and finalized version of a country or nation. Nations are ultimately governed not by laws, rules, or regulations, but by convention. And the dictionary defines a convention as a custom or usage, while the word conventional is defined as following or conforming to approved or established practice. So you can see where the idea of preserving tradition comes from. It's a convention. The point is, and we've seen it being demonstrated in spades over the past several years, is that it doesn't matter what the laws of a given nation may prescribe. If no one is obeying or enforcing them, then they're not worth the paper they're written on. If people do accept and obey certain laws which are enforced by government, then those laws are valid. In fact, much of ordinary day-to-day government might be best served by consciously operating on convention, and often the introduction of laws and regulations into areas where convention has already been established can be a sign of trouble to come. But the recognition that we are mostly governed or ruled by convention still doesn't really resolve the eternal issue regarding which of those conventions, if that's how we're going to look at it, are just right to maintain and preserve a free society. To that end, we must establish a conventional acceptance of free speech and of free discussions such as those heard on this show. And in that context, here's hoping that your conventional traditions include your joining us each week as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until next time, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
All we have to do is write a check and then we can all relax. But if people in government start talking about it, you know what will happen?
No.
In the end, they'll start thinking about it. They will come to realize the problems, the flaws in the reasoning. The nation will get worried. Agitation, questions, criticism, change.
Change?
change.
Sorry, there is one thing, though.
Mm.
This TV broadcast he's doing, suppose he uses it to announce his new policy.
We can't. First, it have to go through Cabinet and the House.
Well, you can do that in terms of opening the national debate.
Bernard, you do not open a national debate until the government has privately made up its mind.
But if the Prime Minister's made up his mind...
Then he must unmake it.
But he's the Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed he is, Bernard. He has his own car, nice house in London, place in the country, endless publicity, and a pension for life. What more does he want?
I think he wants to govern Britain.
Well, stop him, Bernard.